The Guardian.
Music Weekly, sponsored by Cartier's Love Day. How far would you go for love?
Bling, bling! Welcome to Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I am Paul McInnes, and on this week's show... That is the sound of the Reverend and the Makers. We'll be leaving the Makers to their own devices, but talking to the Reverend, John McClure, about live music and some unlikely new collaborations. We'll also be reviewing new music from Foles, Gnarls Barkley and The Presets. We'll get to the bottom of who you think is the greatest rapper alive. Sorry, Lil Wayne. But first, we're going to speak to Mika P. Hinton.
I'm not afraid of the suffering or the pain. I'm just afraid of dying without finding you.
That was Dying Alone, a live track, the full of which you can hear at the very end of this pod, by Mika P. Hinton, our studio guest this week. My colleague, Rosie X. Swash, joins me in the studio. Hello, X.
Is that like Richard X?
Yeah, it's pretty much like that. But also because, you know, because of your slave name and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
Since you joined the 5% Nation of Islam, that's all changed. Now, tell our listeners about Mika P. Hinton.
Mika P. Hinton is a singer-songwriter who you heard there. Has a very lovely, rich, deep voice. He's from Texas. He's been around for about 4 or 5 years now, but he's definitely someone who I think his reputation precedes him.
In what regard would that be?
Well, there's a lot of stories that surround him, the drug addiction, the addiction to painkillers, the heartbreak that he suffered from the Vogue model when he was a wee nipper, chronic back injuries that have plagued his career for the last few years, all of which we get behind in the interview and he talks about, oh, and his religious upbringing. Talk about it all in the interview. But the first thing I wanted to know is his new album is called Mika P. Hinton and the Red Empire Orchestra, and I wanted to know what was behind the name.
That's a really good question. I wish you had an answer for me.
It makes me think of communism, yes. And it makes me think of Star Wars.
I like the Star Wars reference. I haven't heard that yet. I've heard the communist thing and things about China and stuff. It seems like my first track was called The Gospel of Progress, and then we had the opera circuit when the names in my mind are created and I feel like, oh, this is what I want to go with. It generally doesn't make any sense. But yeah, I knew when I decided to be the Red Empire Orchestra that there was going to be just those three words put together. It's a very odd thing, especially with the state of the world now, or the cold, especially that I'm an American and we had the whole Cold War thing going on in the past and stuff. But to me, it just sounded a bit like impending doom, and I liked that. Even though the record, I don't think, has an impending doomish sound, I just really felt that it sounded really pretty coming off the tongue.
There must be something in me, as opposed to you and me, as opposed to us. We're always sad.
I have to say, I am a fan of yours, so I followed the saga of your back condition. Basically, for people that don't know, you've had an ongoing condition with your back that meant you just had to keep cancelling shows last year. Did it impede your writing?
Well, I'll give you a brief synopsis. When I was in college, I had a friend named Luke Sinner, and we were actually celebrating, we were having a Burns supper. Everybody was really drunk, and we were having a good time. And my friend, this Luke guy, just punches me square in the back, and the lowest disc in my back, expanded, and it got really disrupted, and it wasn't happy with me. I went touring, and it exploded. All the stuff from inside went into my sciatic nerves and my spine, so my legs were going numb. We had MRI and x-rays, and he said that everything was fine, but I still had all this pain, and I was talking to my normal practitioner, and he was giving me medication, and everybody wanted me off of it, and because it's pretty serious stuff, addiction-wise and health-wise. And so I just began to feel quite crazy because doctors were telling me that I was healthy, and I didn't feel healthy. So it was just a really, really difficult time. I felt like I was losing it a little bit, and with my past history, the fact that you can look up on the internet and see all these nice sundry things that I've done with my life so far, it's really quite hard to get the things that I needed. And so then finally, I guess a couple of months ago, we went and saw a guy, a really young doctor, a neurosurgeon in Texas, and we looked at my MRI and got a new x-rays and stuff, and the back is even worse than it was. And so all this paranoia that I had about thinking that I was crazy or a drug addict and all these things, it was none of those things. My back was just properly messed up. I'm in constant pain. And so it's hard, but I guess to go to your question, has it affected my writing? On this album, I wouldn't say so, because I've really gotten into the groove of being a chronic pain patient and having to deal with this stuff.
Complete with all your myths, understandings can barely rise to stand to kill.
So, you know, I'm going to ask you about your past now.
Okay.
It's got to come up. You alluded to it a little bit there.
Okay.
And I guess what you're saying, you used to have an addiction to prescription.
Yes, I did.
So that would be the doctors worrying that you're going, oh, no, it still hurts.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was a long time ago. Was that 5 years ago?
Yes, it was a very long time ago. You know, I was causing trouble when I was a teenager, but, like, the real law stuff, like with the police, that began when I was 19 years old. I was kind of through that phase by the time I was 21. That's the thing that frustrates me a little bit as far as press and that kind of stuff goes, because they make it appear as if music was my savior. And I would say in some ways it was. And it's fine that people make legends of things. It's, you know, on Wikipedia they say that I was born on March 30th. And so that's good, because they don't know my real birthday. and so legends in a way are very good, because it hides the, you know, the honest truth about how my life was. And so, yeah, I guess I have a sordid past, and, you know, I would say I probably have some regrets, but in the end, without those things, I wouldn't be the man, and I wouldn't know what I'd do today.
Talking about the legend of, you know, the creating the legend, the legend of Mika Beanson. One of the first things it says about you on Wikipedia, which I just couldn't, he grew up in a Christian fundamentalist household. And so it's like the idea that you grew up in this horrific, like, God-fearing place and you ran away and, no, he's shaking his head, no. Listeners.
I was raised by exceedingly good parents. You know, they took us to church, you know, Sunday morning and Sunday night. They took us on Wednesday, and I've read the Bible. I know tons of stories. You know, I could, you know, there was a time that I really ran away from that stuff. And so they gave me a lot of amazing things. But no, they weren't fundamentalist. It wasn't fire, hell, and brimstone. You know, I don't think a proper fundamentalist household, I don't think would, you know, would buy a kid a guitar or would introduce him to the things that my parents introduced me to that were really helpful to me. Even though I ignored it for the majority of my life, the things that my parents instilled in me and the things that they taught me are priceless. And all the times that I fought them, you know, there is a lot of a regret and remorse in my soul of the things that I said and that I did to them, knowing now that they just wanted the best for me.
Well, it would be horrible if I read something like that about my family, because apart from anything else, it just implies that you had this totally loveless upbringing.
Right.
Which meeting you is obviously the total opposite.
Oh, no,
it's
no,
true.
No. They were... At times, they were so loving that it really pissed me off. You know what I'm saying? But in the end, they just wanted the best for me. Like you've alluded to, the word fundamentalist sounds loveless and terrible, and that's not what they were at all.
Where does music fit into all of this? You said about your parents, you know, if that was them, they'd have never bought you a guitar. When did they buy you the guitar?
My dad bought me my first guitar before my fifth grade talent show. I must have been 10 or 11, something like that. And we did like a mock cover, you know, we're just like lip syncing or whatever to Weird Al Yankovic's cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit. And then my brother got really sick. And so during this time, he got to skip a lot of school, and he sat around the house, and my dad bought him a guitar, and And he just started tearing it up. I mean, he just got really, really good. And so for a while, it was a competition to see who would be the best. And I won in the end.
What were the other influences? What were you listening to? You know, what bands?
I was listening to Boys to Men, Michael Jackson, like the Black and White record, and some pretty scary stuff. But then my brother started coming home. I remember one Christmas, he got a present, and it was the Staring at the Sea, the singles collection by The Cure. And I remember, you know, hearing Killing an Arab, and I remember hearing The Forest, and just there was just something different. It felt like proper music, like these people had purpose. They were saying something real. And so then from there, I remember going to the record store pretty soon after that, and I bought Without a Sound by Dinosaur Jr. And I remember sitting in front of the stereo, and every single song was good. And it really just quite blew my mind, because up until that point, you didn't have records like that. You had, you know, like a Michael Jackson record, for example, you'd have a couple of songs that were really good that were the singles, and the rest were just kind of like filler parts. No offense to Michael Jackson, you know, Billie Jean's great and all that, you know. But there was something about realizing that a record could be good through and through. And that's actually when I began to wanting to write songs. Music was a huge influence over my life, and I'm really thankful. I'm thankful for it, and it's odd because I'm kind of thankful my brother got so sick, because I might not have wanted to play guitar so much to get better than him. Healthy competition is good. Maybe deathly illness isn't. I don't know.
And that's Mika P. Hinson, and his new album, Mika P. Hinson and the Red Empire Orchestra, is out on July 14th, and he'll be playing London's Bush Hall in July.
Thank you, Rosie. And as I mentioned earlier, we've also got a live track from Mika P. coming up at the end of the show, so stay tuned for that one. Now, let us frolic merrily into the meadow of new music, pick a few choice tunes, inhale their sweet aroma, and then stamp on them. Yes, it's time for Singles Club. And joining us is Man About Town No More, Mr. Tim Jones.
I'm locked to a desk.
You're locked to a new desk. You have a new home, don't you?
I am, I do.
It's not a wedding.
I've been getting up so early for this bloody job. I can't even speak.
Your mind is addled. But you are the new editor of the Guardian's music website. Is this not correct?
I am, and you are my new boss.
That's right.
Which means, I will say, that I'm looking forward to taking it to the next level, enjoying every second.
I will be working my knees into the ground in order to so do, etc., etc. Well, it's great to have you on board the website. Really excited, but even better to have you on the pod today, Tim. It's business time, as they say on the Flight of the Conchords, so let's get listening to music. This is Gnarls Barkley with Going On. That was Going On by Gnarls Barkley. CeeLo and Danger Mouse, a.k.a. Gnarls Barkley, got to number one in 9 countries with their first single, Crazy. Their album, St. Elsewhere, did similarly well, and the duo released a new collection of psychedelia-tinged soul music, The Odd Couple, this year. Amongst other looks, the pair have dressed up as Roman Centurions, Austin Powers and Mini-Me, Darth Vader and C-3PO, a couple of droogs from A Clockwork Orange, 1970s tennis players, and Freddy Krueger and Jason from Out of the Friday the 13th movies. Anyone would have thought they were keen on publicity. Rosie Swash, are you keen on this song?
No. It's formulaic and it's thin and it sounds like a bland album track that could have been on the first album, and that is outshone by everything they've done previously.
What would you say the formula is that they're sticking
with? Well, they definitely kicked off a trend for the 60s retro soul sound that Mark Ronson then produced with his album Versions. And I guess that's part of the problem, that it doesn't sound new. Whereas when Crazy came out, I think a lot of people thought, wow, what is this? This sounds really unusual. It sounds fantastic. And it just sounds like they've just done a copy of all the elements they used for the first album. It just sounds like they're not even trying. The first album had a lot of elements, like there was a real psychological element to it because of CeeLo wrote the music and he has had battles with mental health issues before. It had some really weird elements in there, and this just sounds like it hasn't got any life in it whatsoever.
Yeah, Tim, it sounds almost like the really weird elements are kind of deliberately on the fringes of this song, the slightly odd guitar, the noodly electro effect at the end.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen closely, it's quite a nice production, and obviously it's Danger Mouse, and it would do. It's interesting, Rosie said it's very formulaic, and I do agree with that. And I think a lot of the reviews kind of made out that they weren't bothered about writing another Crazy, and that wasn't what they're about. But I don't think the album or this song's weird enough for that. I think they kind of are trying to write another pop song, but they just haven't got that melody to go with it. And this is a fine song to me, but it's an album track, and it's not going to set the world alight.
How was the album done? It hasn't really...
It's done really badly. The first album, St Elsewhere, was number one in loads of different countries, and Crazy was. And Crazy had other great singles to follow it, Smiley Face particularly. This one's, I mean, like the 70s and stuff in America, so really not very good at all.
All right, that's Going On by Niles Barkley and is out on June the 16th. Second track on Singles Club is Red Sox Pugy by Foals. In contact, she said. OK, that's Foals with Red Sox Pugy. Foals have been on this pod before, August the 23rd, 2007 edition to be exact, and they guest-edited Guardian / Music, so our critical integrity may in some way be compromised. So let us balance things out a little by saying that we think lead singer Yanis's haircut is rubbish. Now we've done that, we can also observe that Red Sox Pugy were the words on a baseball cap that Yanis once bought in an unspecified European country. That's a fact. We phoned up to check that one out. Tim.
Why is he named a song after a baseball cap?
Because they're a bit arty.
Whenever I hear it Foals, I imagine what they think they've created. And I bet they think this is like a mixture of Autechre and, you know, some field recordings of people in 1950s Egypt eating with... You know,
spoons.
Yeah, but it sounds a bit like Radiohead, Block Party. It's all right, it's got a lot of echo. The album was originally produced by David Sitek and then they ditched him because he didn't make it too reverby. But this sounds quite reverby to me.
I disagree with the tune bit. I think it's quite catchy later on. It is quite a long, sprawling tune. I do sometimes feel with a band, do they have a heart? And if so, can you ever hear it in their music?
I don't find it particularly moving in any way. In that kind of emotional way. I just find it so middle-of-the-road indie music. And the bit you said where it does have a tune, that's almost a sub-Coldplay there, isn't it? It's like the big guitar chorus.
It's interesting that you should say about them having a heart, because this...
is about a heart.
Yeah, it is about a heart, the vessels and all that. But the whole math rock thing and the mathletics, and they have a phrase, they have a motif, and they just chop it up and mess around with it in the songs which they've done here. And that in itself, I guess, is what math rock is all about. It's like variations on a theme. As for the song, I think it actually reminded me of that very strong clashing percussion at the beginning, and then the simple, moody chords. It reminded me of Portishead, Not a Bad Thing.
No, I mean, and neither Radiohead nor Block Party are bad points of comparison either, I suppose.
No, I just think they always feel like they are taking it to some kind of amazing... They almost think they're pioneers.
They're definitely pretentious, yeah. But I don't dislike that about them.
Well, I do.
Yes, boss.
Point of happy...
Can we just redo that again where Rosie says, I agree that they think they're pioneers, but they're not.
Sorry, boss.
No, I think you should hold that one in your back pocket for 6 months down the line. Anyway, I think a point of happy discord is would be a good point to move on. That was Red Sox Pugy by Foals, and it's out on June the 9th. The last this track of all on Singles Club this week is This Boy's in Love by The Presets. Don't tell the world why. That was The Presets with This Boy's in Love. The Presets are Julian Hamilton and Kim Moyes, an electronic duo from Sydney, Australia. It's probably worth clarifying that by electronic duo, we don't mean that The Presets are robots. They are, as far as we know, human. Being Australian, they are signed to Modular Records, home of the Avalanche's Cock Copy, and who could forget Wolf Mother. Rosie.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and say something contentious. LCD sound system light?
Crapper than that. Much crapper. Similar to Cut Copy. I don't know what it is about Australia, but they love to sound like their 80s kind of... We think we're being really moody synth pop. We think we sound like Depeche Mode. The problem with this song is that dance music does in a really simple level. Like, for example, someone like Justice, they understand that, you know, you've got to have the big drops. The sounds have got to be really big. And this is just light on everything. It just trundles along. It's very boring.
Tim, you love it though, don't you?
I don't mind it, actually.
I do
think it is a bad song, but I quite like it. And I think it does a good job of, if you heard it when you were altered, I think it would go down very well. And obviously you can say that about a lot of songs, but I think it's got a bit of melody to it. But I agree with what you say about Australian dance music. They do seem a bit behind, and Pendulum, they're from Australia, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think that is a perfect example.
Have you seen Pendulum, though? They're like, they've got two songs in the top 40, their album's in the top 10, they're going ballistic. I'd like to point out that we interviewed them ages ago, and it was only me who wanted to do it, and I did it, not because I like the music, because I thought, emo plus dance music, it's going to go huge. And it is.
I would have actually not thought that would have gone huge. It seems so dated to me. I'm amazed.
I'm going to draw on another kind of inaccurate comparison here, but they make me think of the Hold Steady preset. In that you listen to them and you think they sound like old people, but like old people trying to embrace the vigour of their youth again and the music of their youth and do it for themselves and really live it out. For all I know, they may actually be 23 years old, but it sounds not only Australian but old, but happy with it.
Do you like it?
I listened to the whole album. Well, a music journalist listens to the whole album. But no, I did listen to the whole album, and none of the songs really stood out to me. None of them sounded like they had an edge at all. But yet I did listen from beginning to end. I think they are quite good at compressing stuff into 3.5 minutes, and they can make their electronica into a pop song. And I think that's something in itself.
I just think there's no drama to them.
I think I would probably concur. But as you get older, drama increasingly slips out of your life, Rosie. And that really unnecessarily sad-sounding note. The Boys in Love by The Presets is out now. But some of your reviews from last week's pod, as you know, we encourage you to post your reviews of the music that we have already reviewed. Flawed Genius, he said of Lil Wayne's Lollipop, one of last week's tracks, aside from a marginally interesting tone to his voice, the track has nothing that makes it stand out from the other wallpaper hip-hop and R&B. Sure, it'll probably sell by the bucket load and be played to death on the dance floors of crap clubs, but really, you guys weren't being serious, were you? Well, I'm afraid, Flawed Genius, I think we all were, but if it's any consolation to you, Flawed, I didn't like it then, and heck, I don't like it now. We're going to come back to the topic of Lil Wayne and his skills a little later on in the show, so we shall move on. But we also reviewed DIOYY? aka Does It Offend You? Yeah. And within 30 seconds of the very pod going live, or close to it anyway, Marquee had posted the following. Does It Offend You? Yeah, have fallen into the trap of assuming that parodying every London act that has appeared on the front of the NME is enough. Unfortunately, it's just like an impressionist doing the voice alone, with no wit to the routine or insight into the characters. Good post.
He is good, isn't he?
He's good, he's very good. Live on 35mm also deduced an element of pastiche. I'm not offended by Does It Offend Blah Blah. They are just a meaningless mix of klaxons and Daft Punk with a guitarist that follows Hendrix's dreams without realising his mates are playing something different. This charming Mark, however, confessed to simple bewilderment. Last time I read NME, they referred to some band called DIOYY, and it took me ages to work out who they were referring to. Mark, I have to explain, that was simply because they left the question mark off. No question mark, could be a completely different band. As for Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks, the blog consensus seemed to be similar to that in the pod, that the new stuff isn't as good as the old ones. As Chaz and Dave put it, listen to Old Pavement, 'tis far more rewarding. So we want more of that this week, please, and you can post your thoughts at blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. After all that excitement, what better way to follow than with a lovingly handcrafted montage? Feeder. We are the people. Just like the people. Alicia Keys, Teenage Love Affair.
I love our secret meeting on a fifth floor staircase. White horses, they will take me away.
Portishead, The Rip.
Numbers.
Ah, Montage, I love you. Has a man ever married a series of sound clips? If not, then please let me be the first. Tim, you were just saying you discovered the music. Is that like saying you're Lord of the Dance?
I was actually saying I discovered music.
Oh.
And the things we all listened to today were invented by me, which is what I thought got me the job.
But I discovered fire, did I tell you that?
I did. It's funny hearing the music because it does sound quite dated now, but I did watch one of their first gigs when they played in Leeds, and Tony Wilson was there, and I think I've told this story before, actually.
What, on this pod? Cut it dead.
No, I don't. I want to know the end.
But he was saying, this is the best live band you'll ever see, and he kind of shook me and said, this is going to be amazing.
He was right, wasn't he?
At the time, actually, he was right.
You can't avoid them.
You probably can't remember quite how bad live music was around 1999 or whenever it was.
Wouldn't you think I wasn't born in 1999?
But there was no live bands, was there? That is true. You're not that young, guy.
There were no live bands. He's just coming out with one ridiculous statement after another. I'm going to have to go back and inspect your CV again, just, you know, see whether you really did work for Ronald Reagan in 1986. Anyway, Tim, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
Thank you. I want to get back and do some work. Rosie, get back. I'm going to sit here.
Monitoring your efficiency.
Oh, God.
Anyway, we now close the doors on Singles Club for another week. But remember, you can get Rosie's texticular version on Guardian/Music every week too. Okay, let me just check my list. Invent middle name for Rosie, check. Interview Mika P. Hinson, check. Talk about new music, check. Talk to Gobby Sheffield Demagogue. Ah, our second guest this week is John McClure, a.k.a. the Reverend John McClure, a.k.a. him out of Reverend and the Makers. She used to go out, they used to go to bars. Now it's just rattles and baby food in jars. Know how she's feeling, because there ain't no sex. I know she's reeling, they're at the multiplex. Mams and prams, 12-week scans. Wish you were in a story at the also-rans. Okay, that's He Said He Loved Me by Reverend of the Makers. Now, The Guardian has been involved in some tawdry capitalistic way with a series of O2 wireless weekenders that have been running up and down the country of late. The Rev has been involved too, and we caught up with him at last week's final shindig in Bristol. He told us some surprising and, to be honest, rather impressive projects he's currently working on, but we started by talking about his heavy live schedule and the prospect of playing umpteen festivals over the course of the summer.
It's a very exciting prospect. Festivals are amazing, you know, especially in this country. I think, alongside humour, it's one thing that the British do quite well is a music festival.
Do you think it's the kind of descendant of town fates and our ability to rustle up a raffle at a moment's notice?
Yeah, and also I think we revel in the misfortune of the weather. You know what I mean? We like a bit of hardship, don't we? We kind of love doing that stiff upper lip thing.
Because we're talking to you in Bristol. You're down there, you're playing one of the O2 Wireless Weekenders.
Indeed.
Which is one of these kind of, I suppose, that a localised festival that taking it around to different cities.
Yeah, I think it's good to kind of play things that are outside of London, you know, because the music industry, unfortunately, in this country, in my opinion, is quite London-centric, you know.
Well, there's a resurgence in Manchester with the Ting Tings. There's obviously the Monkees and all their side projects. Do you feel that there is a bit of a northern counterpoint now to that London-centric behaviour?
Not really, no, because everyone still has to go, like, cap in hand to London and get on the knees to the money men, don't they?
Right.
And even the people that have made it from Sheffield, you know, they go and leave and live in London. You go to Scotland, though, you're in the Lake District and stuff, and it's almost like living in a different country.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I don't believe that fashion should be a diktat imposed on the centre, you know what I mean? Because there's loads of little scenes all over the country that people just aren't aware of because they don't get the coverage. Archer detective, what you surmise?
worry that as the record industry sells fewer records and live music is booming, that the industry is paying more attention to the rights of performance and getting money from gigs?
I think these 360 deals are quite worrying. It's almost like the record labels are that desperate to, you know, guarantee the prolonged existence. They're just trying to grab anything they can. I think they can be quite evil, these things, you know. I could be a lot richer and a lot more famous and sell a lot more records if I'd have, you know, dropped to my knees for the free Warner Brothers. Bands like The Feeling are described as an indie band. You know, when I see these big record labels struggling and stuff, I just think, you know, to hell with you, down with you. I'll laugh as you're burning hell, you know what I mean?
Tell us about your pre-gig routine. What do you do? Do you have any superstitions?
I always listen to Bob Marley, because it always puts me in, like, a positive mindset, you know what I mean?
Do you have a drink before you go on, or do you stay teetotal?
I have a rum and coke, and I have a spliff.
Nice.
You know, I love weed, and I think I'm an advocate of ganja. I think it's a positive thing for society.
Your live shows, they can be incredibly frenetic and almost borderline chaotic, particularly there's a lot of chemistry on stage between you and Laura Manuel. Is that something you had to work on, or has that always been there?
No, not really. When we first started the band, we both had other partners, and there's obviously like a bit of a sexual dynamic that kind of erupted mid-tour about a year and a half ago, you know. I think it's good just to have a girl on stage anyway, because, you know, music's such a male-dominated arena, innit? And I think that to have a feminine perspective is a good thing, you know, because it's good to show that there can be a girl on there who can play an instrument and hold her own with the boys, you know. What if the woman who stands by a fetter, despite the bruises brought on by the Stella, to cook and to clothe and to clean and to screw, is not the sum total of all she can do?
You're playing throughout the summer, you're playing Glastonbury.
Yeah.
When all that comes to an end, will you be heading back to the studio?
Already in the studio already. I'm currently in the process of making three albums. One's the second Reverend the Makers album, which is already underway, which is going to be called A French Kiss in the Chaos. I have another album which is for a Brazilian charity called Bottle Top, which involves me and a friend of mine, Jack Kuna, producing, and then we've had loads of different bands coming in, jamming, and we're going to go to the favela in Brazil and get the kids to play the kind of percussion and stuff. We've had Dirty Pretty Things, Arctic Monkeys, Baby Shambles, The Mystery Jets are coming down. I think Franz Ferdinand, there's loads of different people.
Wow.
You know, lots of different people. I've also started a new band with Andy Nicholson, who used to be in The Monkeys.
Yeah,
the
indeed.
Old bass player. Andy and the drummer, Matt Elders, myself and Joe Moscow from my band, and also Drew McConnell, who's the bass player in Baby Shambles.
Indeed.
Drew's playing the guitar. And there's a British Iraqi rapper called Loki, and we set up a band called Mongrel. I've not been as excited about a new artist, really, ever, I think, because what he's saying really is like, it's incendiary, you know, it's something that I don't feel has been said by a new artist, really. Maybe you can tell me, but in the interim years since 9/11, can you name me any new artists who have, like, really took to task what the governments of our country and America has done? I've tried to have a go, but it was written off as revolutionary rhetoric and one thing and another by the people, really, who were to the left of the spectrum or who would have expected to be my natural supporters, which is a shame because I think at times like this, people who broadly agree with them sentiments should unite behind it.
That was The Reverend, and he is playing an awful lot of dates right now, including Tea in the Park and V. Get the full list at myspace.com/reverendmusic, or one word. Back to the blog now, and as we said earlier, the specific chat about Lil Wayne's Lollipop track did spill over somewhat, and there was much discussion as to whether the New Orleans lad can seriously claim to be the best rapper alive. Rosie, how about we take it in turns here, like kind of points of view, and I'll read one and you can read the next, okay? EJD continued on this theme. Best rapper in the world, no chance. But after a self-imposed ban because of his Hot Boys affiliation, I started to see something in him after his verse in Hollywood Divorced by Outkast and then the aforementioned Feel Like Dying. A contender for best rapper these days for me is Andre 3000, who's thankfully rapping again after his verses in Royal Flush, International Players and Da Art of Storytelling Part 4.
Marquee wrote, "No, Lil Wayne isn't a great rapper per se, but the tone of his voice means that it's as textured and as rhythmic as a dirty synth line."
Martin Cooling replied, "Don't get me wrong, I really enjoy Lil Wayne's ethos and the fact he doesn't quit, he just gets on and does things. Seems nowadays rappers need a new clothing line or acting role to flaunt before they will consider putting out an album. I respect the fact the guy is out there making music because it's what he likes to do and is seemingly not hung up on living the life. But that being said, It's hit or miss across all his releases. Upgrade You was an absolute anthem and my favourite track of his to date, but I do find myself wondering every time I get ready to listen to a new track of his, whether it will go in the monotonous pile or the anthemic pile. In the end, there seemed to be a degree of mature, considered agreement that if Music Weekly posters were nominated, the best rapper alive would be MF Doom. Typically backpackery there, everybody. And thanks to F Frenzy for pointing out their second collaboration between MF Doom and Gnarls Barkley's Danger Mouse under the Danger Doom moniker is soon come. Facebook, we missed you out last week, but the friends have kept rolling in, so we won't miss you again. Here are some of our new pals, which Rosie's going to read out because basically in the points of view thing, she only got to do one bit.
I wasn't going to say anything. You've given me all the hard names. Renato Mercado da Silva, Guru Shabbat, Mark Bamford, Nick Levine, Charlie Heller, Alex Wysom, Rob, make up your last name, Flagship. Thank you all.
Thank you, Rosie.
That went well.
Now, we're about to play you out with some music from Mika P. But first, we thought it worth letting you know who's on next week's show.
Tell me, baby, tell me a pretty lie. See the spider been out catching flies. When you leave me, I know it won't be long before you come on over to me.
That's Turn Me On by Isabel Campbell and Mark Lanigan, and Rosie is already excited about interviewing them for next week's pod. Are we not?
It's a bit saucy, isn't it? That took me by surprise.
I wonder if we're doing some kind of chain now. We're kind of going down an octave with each of the interviewees. We end up with resuscitating Barry White.
Or R. Kelly or something.
R. Kelly. Wouldn't that be great? His first... No, we won't prejudice anything. That's all for this week. We'll be back next. But we leave you with a live track from Mika P. Hinson. That's live, by the way. It's called Dying Alone. See you soon.
Cool. I'm ready. Sunset or the rain, just afraid of dying alone. And what would you find? And what would you say? And what would you mean? Suffering or the pain, I'm just afraid of dying without finding you. And what would you find? And what would you say? What would you mean? What would you find?
And what would you say? And what would you mean? And what would we find? And what could we say? And what could we mean?
Music Weekly, sponsored by Cartier's Love Day.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.